Steam shouldn't exist. Okay, hear me out for a second. I'm definitely glad it exists. I use it like several times a week to buy and play games, and I have a good experience almost every time. But it definitely shouldn't exist. I mean, if I told you that there was a tech company that was founded in the 90s that controlled 70% of its market and that had basically zero meaningful competition, and that the CEO owns a fleet of yachts so big that he needs smaller support yachts for the main one, you'd probably start thinking about guillotines and not video games. And yet, this more or less perfectly describes Valve, the company responsible for Steam. It's basically impossible to name another tech company from that era that has a reputation that's half as good as Valve. And even just a quick Google search will show you a litany of admiration and good reviews for Gabe Newell, the founder, in a way that very few people seem to talk about, say, Zuckerberg or Bezos. Valve and Steam have won at the game of capitalism, and they've effectively monopolized an entire business. And yet, they are, at the same time, lauded as one of the best examples of a consumer-friendly product. And it makes no sense at first glance. So how did they do it? How did Steam beat capitalism without getting greedy? Valve Corporation is without a doubt one of the most important companies in all of technology. It was founded by two guys, Gabe Newell and Mike Harrington, who left Microsoft in 1996 to pursue a dream project, creating their very own video game from scratch. Their debut project was Half-Life, and it was so successful that it still is today considered one of the greatest video games of all time. And since then, they've released a lot of bangers. Half-Life, Team Fortress, and Counter-Strike are all still incredibly popular series and have millions of players every day collectively. But after releasing several extremely popular games themselves, they noticed a few issues with the games industry. If you're a little older, you might remember a time when pirating a PC game was comically easy. Literally within a few days, you could get free software and bypassed most security measures with like a few seconds of Googling. And we saw the first wave of companies getting really desperate to put the lid on piracy. When Doom 2 was leaked weeks before its official release, their developer responded by banning any pre-launch reviews or external testing for their next game, Quake. The then vice president of marketing even announced that no copy of our games would leave the building. Except that game ended up also being leaked 3 days before its release. Some kid literally just broke into their network and downloaded the game in front of them, and they were so young that the company didn't even bother pressing charges. This state of affairs, though, wasn't all fun and games. The lack of security also made games way more prone to hacking and cheating, and it was super difficult for game developers to have a clean method to offer security and performance patches over the lifespan of the game. And this is where Steam came in. You see, Gabe Newell has a pretty famous take on piracy.
What's Valve's take on piracy?
So we don't really worry about piracy. There's misconceptions in the industry about what piracy is, that they don't want to pay any money and they want to get your content. But when you look at the fact that these people have, you know, $2,000 PCs, clearly they're willing to spend money. Everybody in the United States knows that Russians are pirates. When the reality is that the pirates in Russia were actually doing a much better job than the games companies themselves. And as soon as the product became available at the same time that it was available in Australia or the UK or the United States, and it was localized in Russia, all of a sudden our piracy problems in Russia disappeared. Piracy is the result of bad service.
The whole idea behind Steam was to fix part of the service problem, to combine piracy protection, software updates, and anti-cheat technology all into one platform that was at least as easy to use as the pirate methods. The scope of the project expanded over time to not just include Valve's games, but other people's games and social and community features as well. And, well, they kind of nailed it. Since launching in late 2003, Steam has accumulated over 100,000 games and now has over 40 million daily concurrent users. I think it'd be a stretch to call Valve a game developer like you might have in the 90s. Today, they're a retail business that occasionally develops games on the side. But still, even despite that, the world has changed a lot since 2003, and Valve has followed such a drastically different path than the rest of the tech world. We can compare it with, say, Microsoft, which recently announced that it was increasing prices of its Xbox Game Pass subscription service by 50 to 100%, depending on where you are in the world. Or even Nintendo, which is selling $80 to $90 games. Meanwhile, Steam, on the other hand, has no subscription services, it has a weirdly generous return policy, and several extremely generous sales every year, when that's clearly not the established meta in gaming today. You won't find any reviews like this if you look up their competitors. People don't like wax poetic about the Epic Games Store or about EA Origin. And there are a few really good reasons why Valve behaves the way they do. and seemingly nobody else does. Honestly, we can't talk about this story without acknowledging the elephant in the room. Every time we go online, there are companies that are tracking what we buy, where we live, and literally everything that we click on. Oftentimes, this data ends up in the hands of data brokers, companies that build massive profiles about you and sell them online to advertisers, scammers, and even background check websites. And you've likely never heard of a single one of these brokers before. That's where Incogni comes in, who've kindly sponsored this video. Recently, I received an email letting me know that my personal data had been leaked in a data breach from a website that I used to buy train tickets, of all things. Thankfully, Incogni found hundreds of data brokers and sent legal removal requests on my behalf, forcing them to delete any and all of my personal data. I could do this manually, but there are tons of these brokers, and with Incogni, you don't have to send any emails or fill out any forms. They handle the entire process from top to bottom and keep monitoring these platforms over time, so your data stays off of them for good. You end up with less spam in your inbox, lower risk of identity theft, and even fewer robocalls. Right now, you can get 60% off and a 30-day money-back guarantee with my unique link, incogni.com/fads. So consider checking them out if you want more control over your online data. Thank you to Incogni for sponsoring this video. Let's get back to it. So Valve is a weird company, but not just from the outside. While basically every major tech company from their era decided to become publicly listed on the stock market and solicit investment from the public, Valve has had a really quite different approach. They've remained completely private since being founded, and as a result, it can be hard to find out pretty much anything about how the company works, but some people have done their best to dig deep and get some information. The biggest advantage, first of all, of them being private is how they set goals. A public company like Meta has obligations every quarter. They have to announce and subsequently beat their earnings estimates. The share price has to keep going up, and even a small dip in revenues can be pretty disastrous for the future of a huge publicly listed company. The line has to keep going up, and the collective tech industry realized a while ago that the best way to do that is to acquire as many users as humanly possible. And then you start squeezing them for everything they're worth. You add in a subscription plan and you can get consistent monthly recurring revenue, which makes it easier to create these earnings estimates. You can shoehorn in blockchain, cloud, or AI, depending on what year it is, and you got another couple hundred billion of investment, easy peasy. And the strategy has worked so effectively for them. Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon are all literally trillion-dollar companies. Zuckerberg's platform has decided the results of elections, and Amazon brought in $640 billion in revenue in 2024. Even the most generous estimates put Valve's revenue at like 1 to 2% of a platform like Amazon. And that's a pretty big downside if your goal is to make the biggest company on the planet, or to become the most powerful person on the planet. But that's not the case at Valve. Being private offers a hell of a lot of benefits. You're only bound to the will of a handful of owners who can think on a much longer time frame, who can do stuff because they think it's a good idea, and they don't have to cater to whatever's trendy in the market just to keep their business solvent day to day. You'll actually notice that the Steam interface has barely changed since the original launch. There's no AI chatbot in there, and their changes operate under a whole different calculus, a whole different set of decision-making principles, since being relevant to Wall Street is just not a core part of their business model. They can focus their energy on changes that are actually worth doing, not ones that look like what the market wants to hear. And that philosophy has kind of permeated the entire company from top to bottom. A few years ago, a copy of their internal employee handbook leaked and revealed a lot of weird stuff happening inside Valve. Valve is a company where no one has a formal manager, projects are completely self-organized, and employees decide how they allocate 100% of their work time throughout the week. The handbook literally tells employees that they should only work on a project that they believe is important enough for them to work on. They have a section all about work-life balance, which directs newcomers towards a specific employee that they can speak to if they need more encouragement to take time off. There's so much stuff in here that would never in a million years pass the approval structures of your average public company, where having power over people is kind of the point a lot of the time. Stuff like nobody has ever been fired at Valve for making a mistake, and working overtime for extended periods indicates a fundamental failure in planning at Valve. These things are pretty wild to see in a corporate handbook, and clearly Valve has put a lot of thought into creating a company that actually does seem to get quite a lot out of its people, especially given how small it is. I've kind of been glazing these guys up until this point, alright? And in the world we live in, they're clearly not the worst tech bros out there. But it's important to remember one thing about Valve. It's not a charity, okay? It exists, like literally every other company of this scale, to make a lot of money. And it does that incredibly well. The CEO, Gabe, isn't suffering because of his choices. He hasn't sacrificed anything in the pursuit of his business model, right? He's got an armada of yachts and is currently building a $400 million super yacht, which is about the same price as a Boeing 747 passenger jet. And I don't know how many times you might need to hear this, but you don't get quite to this level without doing at least some degree of shady business. And Valve has not been immune from that. Honestly, the most important reason why Valve continues to operate the way it does is because it works incredibly well at making money. Their revenue per employee is higher than basically every other major tech company, and they just like print money with Steam, which is likely the reason why we've seen so few actual game releases from a company that was created to release games. It makes a lot more sense to just sell other people's games and benefit from the upside of a successful hit, and take little to no risk if a huge project flops on their platform. Even once you're aware of the main factors behind Valve's success, their unique corporate structure, their good leadership, focus on consumer experience and strong hiring, it can be a little difficult to understand why they haven't been dethroned yet, especially given that the competition collectively has access to trillions of dollars. Now, part of it is just that the PC market has grown year on year. It's so unbelievably cheap and easy to access the PC gaming world, especially compared to 2003, and Valve has been rewarded handsomely for that. And while they've been able to achieve this level of growth without actually like seriously mistreating their consumers or their employees, they've not necessarily been as nice to everyone else involved in the game development process. As they've grown, the pressure that they've put on game developers and game publishers, especially the smaller ones, has been getting a little bit out of hand. So Steam takes a 30% cut of all sales through the platform, which is ludicrously high. For context, a website like eBay takes about 12 to 15%, while other game sale platforms take even less. Epic Games takes nothing on the first $1 million in sales, and even the famously generous Microsoft only takes 12% of sales on its store. And in a fairer world, game developers could take advantage of lower fees on other platforms to offer better prices to customers. If I was a game developer that needed to make $7 per copy sold in order to recoup my initial costs, then I could charge $10 on Steam as a minimum, since they take 30%. And I could charge, say, $7 on Epic, since the first $1 million in sales has zero fees. Customers would get cheaper games, the devs would get the same amount of money. It's one of the clearest win-wins ever. Except that Valve is well aware of this, and forces developers to agree to what's known as a Most Favored Nation clause in its agreements. An MFN, a Most Favored Nation clause, basically means that a developer can't sell their game substantially cheaper elsewhere if it's also listed on Steam. It means that even if another platform cuts the fees that they take, the developers aren't allowed to pass on the savings from that deal to the end consumer. If a game is $10 on Steam, it has to be about $10 everywhere else. And very few games can survive without being on Steam, given that they have all of the customers. It's created a setup where Steam looks like the best deal, in part because it literally pressures developers and publishers to not offer a better deal elsewhere. And while most competitor platforms actually offer pretty generous deals to smaller developers, Steam does the opposite. Games that sell millions and millions of copies end up receiving a better split. This isn't because, I don't know, Activision needs the money, but it's because Valve understands as a company that the big developers are the ones who have the true bargaining power, the ones who could have a significant impact if they tried to leave. And by offering them these generous deals, they encourage them to stay on Steam from day one. Indie developers who sell 50, 100, or even 10,000 copies of a game don't have a fraction of the bargaining power, and so there's no need to offer them a better deal. I mean, this is like clearly pretty anti-competitive if you ask me, but from a marketing and PR sense, it's actually genius. Steam always ends up having the best price possible on its platforms. The customers always get what looks like a reasonable deal, and Valve doesn't bear any responsibility if a game ends up being more expensive than the public expected. The blame falls squarely on the developers. Meanwhile, other platforms can't easily compete on price and have to compete on other things, which is why you see exclusive releases as a method of competition. But people hate having to download a whole separate app to play one game, because it's annoying and it feels anti-competitive. It feels like the wrong way to compete in this space. And by the way, I'm not like pretending that the Epic Games Store is like some pariah of the gaming industry, okay? They would definitely be doing the same shit if they could, right? They're just annoyed that they can't. They're actually really annoyed that they can't, because the CEO of Epic Games has been on this warpath for many years now. And the reality is, their app is not the best, not just because of these anti-competitive practices that they're subject to, but also because the Epic Games Store is not very good. And many of these alternatives are just not very good to use. They can be buggy and laggy, while Steam ultimately, at the end of the day, provides a very functional service. The point that I'm actually making here is that Steam has monopoly power in this market. And they're using this power to do what all private monopolies always end up doing, restricting consumer choice and restricting competition. Until recently, Apple did a very similar thing. They'd take 30% of all in-app purchases that were done on Apple devices. Apps were literally not even allowed to tell their users that Apple was just taking 30% of the money and that you could sign up through Google Chrome or whatever for a discount. Apple wasn't taking this 30% fee because they were providing some amazing extra service when you bought your Fortnite V-Bucks. They did it because, much like Steam, they have completely unreasonable levels of control over the mobile app market, and they can get away with it. And it was a major legal issue until earlier this year when a long-standing lawsuit forced Apple to let developers offer alternate payment methods with lower fees. And in my opinion, this is basically identical to what Steam does in gaming. Except they were smart enough to realize that they needed to keep the biggest publishers on side, and they couldn't push it too far. Instead of trying to get 30% out of literally everyone, like Apple did, they made it an explicit point to offer more generous deals to the bigger clients. And again, let me remind you, Steam is actually a pretty good service, right? Mostly just works. But that doesn't mean it's not also holding an unfair market position. And it's no surprise that Valve are actually currently facing a class action lawsuit from a group of developers who allege exactly this. And they brought receipts. An economist quoted in the lawsuit even estimated that in a properly competitive environment, Steam wouldn't take more than like 17 to 18% of sales, as opposed to 30%. This is literally billions of dollars that would end up back in the hands of developers. It's not like chump change. And I think we let Valve and Steam off for a lot of this behavior because they're often seen as like a neutral middleman who only exists to make the process of gaming smoother. And they do that, but they do a lot more too. When I began looking into Valve as a company, I quickly found out that they have some pretty important issues that they're yet to solve. Despite the fact that they give employees tons of freedom to decide what they work on, their staff rarely stay as lifelong Valve employees. One analyst even said that, "I've not met anybody who had a career there. They last long enough to make money, but the developers that I've known there have left for greener pastures because the company doesn't publish games." But you'll notice that Valve hasn't actually completely given up on games. And the ones they've decided to keep tell us a lot about Valve's thinking. Once upon a time, they were really best known for single-player experiences. Games where you pay once and you had all of the content. However, ever since the release of Team Fortress 2, an online multiplayer shooter, they realized you didn't need to make new games to make money. You needed to make more money from the games you'd already created. And thus was born the microtransaction. Instead of concepting, researching, and developing a whole new game, why not just sell cheap items that add on to an existing game? But the real genius wasn't selling like cheap collectibles and letting people buy them. It was letting people gamble for them. In 2010, Valve launched the Supply Crate, an in-game item for Team Fortress 2, which allowed you to receive a random in-game cosmetic item. Except to receive the item, to unlock the crate, you had to purchase a key with real money. Basically, you paid a small amount of money for the chance to receive an item that was worth potentially hundreds or thousands of dollars, or potentially an item worth nothing. This is the infamous loot box. And shock horror, it turns out people, especially kids, quite like gambling. Valve developed item marketplaces and whole in-game economies around these items, wherein people would sell them for real money, use them to launder illicit money, or just do some old-school degen gambling. The loot box mechanic has been so successful that it's present in basically every actively maintained Valve title. While they weren't the first to use this mechanism, they definitely popularized it by creating marketplaces that integrated smoothly the in-game value of items with actual dollar value and let people swap them easily for cash. And Valve makes a killing from this. One Counter-Strike tracker estimated that Valve had made $1 billion just in 2023. From selling loot boxes in the Counter-Strike games. There are so many testimonies of former players of these games where they detail getting addicted to gambling as kids, especially in a game like Counter-Strike. And Valve hired leading economists to analyze their in-game economies, and they have a really intimate understanding of this stuff. They just have zero incentive to change things. The vast majority of people who play these games won't spend a penny, except the percentage that are susceptible to gambling addiction will spend all of their money on it. In the world of mobile gaming, which relies on a very similar model, about 50% of the revenue comes from just 0.1% of the user base. And we don't have numbers for Valve, but I don't imagine it's a mile off from this. When gambling regulators have tried to shut down these systems, Valve responds not by removing them from the game, but by trying to tweak them and design alternative systems that keep as much of the gambling feel as legally possible. Valve has created what Yanis Varoufakis, one of their former economists, would call a digital fiefdom. It markets itself as a neutral middleman, but it actually has a hell of a lot of power for deciding what happens on its territory. Developers depend completely on them, and they have an unfathomable amount of consumer data and complete dominance of their market. And anyone that uses Steam to sell games is under a lot of pressure to remain on Valve's good side. They're more like medieval lords than they are medieval marketplace operators. And currently they've been pretty nice with that power, especially to the people at the end of the chain, the consumers. But they're under no obligation to keep that up, and I struggle to believe that Valve will keep being quite as nice if their margins ever get hit or if they have a change of leadership. We need to create a more robust system by making sure there's actual competition in this space. And if it's still not clear why competition is so important, you can just replace Steam with any other company that has this much control over a digital marketplace, whether it's Apple or Amazon, and it might become a bit more obvious as to where the problems could emerge in time. All in all, things could be a lot worse, and my experience, and most people's experience with Steam, has been pretty good. But good enough is not good enough, okay? The standard that Steam has set for users should be the norm. It shouldn't be an exception. And in fact, it's very much the exception that proves the rule. Steam's level of quality should be the bare minimum that we tolerate, and I don't think that's too much to ask.